Many of us saw the missile alert on our phones last month, but what about workers who aren't allowed to carry their cell phones with them on the job? Last month, we first reported about the issue of panic buttons as a possibility because of the sexual harassment that hotel housekeepers often face on the job. The Hotel Workers Union sits down with us for some frank talk about whether housekeepers should be allowed to carry cell phones and what's the downside. Last month on The Conversation, the Hawaii Lodging and Tourism Association raised the issue as it surveyed members. Could cell phones sound the alert for everything from missiles to sexual harassment?
Just getting an alert on a missile attack or a tsunami doesn't solve what you do about it. Doesn't have the hotels have a plan in place. Should you drop everything and go protect your family, or should you stay and help protect the guests? And, you know, this is something that the tsunamis have already raised, you know, where our members had that, you know, that big tsunami one that hit. You know, we were all in Waikiki that night, and, you know, workers were like, I gotta go home. And the hotel's like, hey, wait, we need help, you know, because the guests are far away from their homes. Who's going to take care of them? So, you know, our members, like any human being, would be torn between those two duties to the family and to the guests, you know. And so, just having a phone in and of itself doesn't solve any of those problems. It doesn't solve the question that the government has not put any plan in place on what to do if there was a missile attack. You know, I mean, we were arguing about whether or not this false alarm should have been hit, but if it were real, okay, then what? So you get 15 minutes warning, what are you going to do? And I remember when I was a kid, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, in elementary school, they made us, you know, we had a plan. We were going to walk around here up there. You know, I went to Lincoln School, so we were going to go up to the punch bowl in those old ammo, you know, magazines that got dug into the hill, and all of that wouldn't have worked either. But we had a plan. So this time, you know, everybody's freaking out about this false alarm, and yet there is no plan. The fact is, no governor, no state government has put any money or attention into driving that plan. We can blame the guy who hit the button. We can blame the governor. But no previous governor solved this either. And, you know, and some of the problem, from what I can see, was, you know, just bad software management in some cases, you know. So to the extent that this is a good thing, it's a good thing that people have to look at this. But you have to raise that basic question is, are we any safer by knowing we're about to get blown up or not? But the fact is, you know, how do we protect? In this case, the question you're asking is, does cell phones, would that give us additional protection? And I think it would give us a tool that could provide that. But it's not going to be enough. Okay, everybody who missed the alert, what would they have done different?
You know? Well, we're raising the question because some industries, and apparently the Lodging and Tourism Association polled their members, and that was one of the things that came up is, should we allow our housekeepers to carry phones, you know, whether it's, as Mufi Hanneman put it, whether it's for a missile alert or a tsunami or a sexual harassment incident or a active shooter on the 11th floor, would that help us in an emergency situation? You know, same thing, we looked at handy van drivers, they're not allowed to have cell phones. So, what are the downsides and the plus sides? You seem concerned about the cell phones could be used for tracking and
well, yeah, they already are being used in that fashion. You know, they're increasingly automating housekeeping dispatch work, for example. They're using software to do that, in essence, cell phone software. And we're going to see more and more of our work being transferred to cell phones. You know, I mean, already I can check in on an app and get a key design and go straight to my room in these hotels that have equipped themselves, and more will do so. I don't even have to see a front desk clerk going in or out. So what's, you know, so this cell phone stuff is a two-edged sword in a variety of ways. It's being used to kind of monitor, and they have programs that will do this, and they're going to be rolled out, and we're going to have to deal with it, where, you know, the cell phone that you're carrying is going to, just like these step counter programs, you know, I saw in the paper how that came out, and just step counter programs mean, in essence, you're able to find military bases.
Right.
So there's unintended consequences. And so, you know, the cell phone would give management a tool to use to monitor workers' activity and direct it, and that's all stuff they would like to do.
So basically, they'd be timing the housekeepers. You're spending way too much time in room 1129. Hurry up. Get on to the next one.
What were those 30 steps you took at 1107? And where were you going? You know, and, you know, so there's any in any situation like this, it cuts both ways. So certainly we don't oppose it. I mean, our members want to carry their phones, and it's not just for this reason. I mean, how do you know if your daughter missed a bus and is at the bus stop and it's getting dark and you need to know that? And how do you find that out? And, you know, you can call the hotel and you can call the department. You can't always get a call through. So, you know, it cuts both ways. And so, like anything else, we would have to, you know, we would have to try to separate those out and deal with it. To try to deal with the good stuff and the bad stuff. And, of course, management might see what's good and bad differently from what we do. So it's not surprising to me that, you know, that the hotel, I mean, Mufi represents the hotel managements. And so when he surveyed them, he's speaking, you know, what management's view would be. And he's busy raising the question, gee, all these years we've been telling them don't carry them, maybe we should change that. And I think that's a legitimate question and should be addressed by the hotel managers. But it's not going to be just one way. You know, and, you know, we talked to, you know, I think you had a previous discussion about panic buttons and that sort of thing in the light of all this Me Too stuff and the sex harassment issues that, you know, finally are getting proper attention. You know, and we are a union of women. You know, 3/4 of our members are women. And so this is vitally important to us. You know, so, you know, we have in other cities these panic buttons, and, you know, and that's a useful tool. But by itself, it's not going to solve the problem. The companies have a conflict of interest in this regard. They can basically kick somebody out for harassing an employee, and that person can then go right across the street and take their business to some other hotel. And so in order for the panic buttons to work, I think we would have to, you know, to work as intended, as we would hope they would work. We would also have to pass, like Chicago has done and Seattle has done, an ordinance where all hotels would have to
Buy in.
Would have to deal with it the same way. Otherwise, every hotel is going to be worried. And the people who do this stuff, many of them are very wealthy people who have that sense of entitlement that gives them the idea that they can do this in the first place.
Right, it's all about power.
Yes, and but in this case, money. Because if, you know, if you take one of these high rollers and you basically 86 them out of the hotel, they take $1 million of business across the street. So we would need the community as a whole to take a stand on this and require everybody to do it so that we can take away that conflict of interest, which would then allow and encourage and properly incentivize the hotels to do the right thing by workers who are being harassed.
That was Eric Gill, head of Local 5, the hotel workers union that represents 8,500 employees. The labor contracts for about a dozen hotels expires this summer, and the issue of cell phones or panic buttons could be on the table.
On February 24th, HPR's Atherton Studio is the setting for a rare rhythm summit, featuring three of Hawaii's premier musicians, Kenny Endo, Noel Okimoto, and Dean Taba. Get your tickets for this evening of world music and jazz fusion in the Atherton on the 24th at hprtickets.org. Preferred pricing for station members. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a healthcare provider takes a hard look at his profession. But first, your quiz.
Since we heard from the Hotel Workers Union today on The Conversation, our backyard quiz centers on a famous strike in Hawaii's history. Being an island state, Hawaii imports a great deal of consumer goods, and that makes Hawaii almost entirely dependent on the shipping industry. With almost 90% of our goods brought here by boat, just the words dock strike can cause families to run to their nearest big box store and start stockpiling the essentials. Many can still remember two major dock strikes in Hawaii's labor history. In 1941, 2,000 ILWU members walked away from their jobs and demanded equal pay to their mainland counterparts. That strike lasted 177 days and froze all shipping activity to and from the islands. Later in 1971, the Great West Coast Dock Strike halted all shipments to Hawaii and went on for 134 days. Unemployment soared. Many shops were forced to close their doors for good. Both strikes left our economy crippled and our store shelves empty. But there was one strike that lasted almost as long as both of these combined. So for our backyard quiz today, can you name the longest strike in Hawaii's history? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. No need to cross the picket line for this one. We'll get you the answer later in our show.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, offering flexibility for on-the-go students and families with 24/7 access to Achieve 3000 Hawaii Edition, online or offline. Achieve3000.com.
Dr. Robert Pearl lost his father to a medical error. He's seen too many preventable mistakes in the course of his career as a physician and as a medical group CEO. He's made it his mission to bring flaws in the system out in the open. He's the author of Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong. He's with us in our studio. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Aloha.
Why we think we're getting good health care. I wonder if we continue to think that. It's the reputation of American health care is eroding, isn't it?
So a couple of things. First, in terms of the book, I wrote Mistreated, as you said, because of my father's untimely death,
right,
but also to improve the American health care system. And by the way, all the profits go to a charity, Doctors Without Borders, who are doing great work around the world. The book focuses on the difference between objective reality and perception. As an example, if you looked at the Stanford Prison Experiment, you take volunteers, you put them together, half get aviator sunglasses, the guards, half get OR greens with numbers, mm-hmm. the prisoners. Within 48 hours, the guards see the prisoners as dangerous, criminals who could do harm.
And they start abusing them.
They abuse them. They can clean toilet bowls with their bare hands. And the prisoners see the guards as sadistic. They board up the doors. Everyone knows that each person is just a student.
These are just hypothetical situations, and yet they act as if they were real.
Because context shapes perception, changes behavior. The point you're making, you look at American healthcare. My dad was one of 200,000 people that year and every year since to die from preventable medical error. Add on the people who don't get the preventive care they need, the people who have chronic disease and get complications. When I was the CEO of the Permanente Medical Group in Kaiser Permanente, caring for 5 million people, we were able to, as an example, lower the chances of getting colon cancer in half by being able to do the preventive screening that's necessary. The opportunity to lower the chance of stroke by 40% by controlling blood pressure. But people don't see that as being so important. They're much more concerned about the newest drug, the newest test, newest procedure. even when they don't do a whole lot of positive for healthcare outcomes.
We've been hearing for years from the medical community that there was an effort to move toward prevention, but you're saying we're far from there yet.
Far from it. As I said, in the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, we're at 92%. The rest of the nation's 55%. Let me give you another great example where perception changes behavior.
92% of what?
92% of patients with high blood pressure were well controlled. The rest of the nation, 55% control rate. That difference is 40% lower strokes. But I'll give you a really great example, hand washing.
Right.
What do we know? We know that the third leading cause of death in the hospitals is hospital-acquired infection.
Mm-hmm.
80 studies have shown that one-third of the time when doctors go from one room to another, they fail to wash their hands. This is not any one hospital, one system. It's everywhere. Now, doctors are very motivated. They care about their patients a lot. The last thing they'd ever want is the idea that they're going to hurt someone under their care. And yet they do. Third leading cause of death. Why is that? Because just like in that Stanford prison experiment, the context, they're late for the office, there's an extra patient, there's something they need to do, they're in a rush, and they skip this life-saving step.
Is a lot of what they do in the course of their busy day redundant?
A tremendous amount of redundancy. It's been estimated that as much as 30 or 40% of what we do adds little value.
Wasted time.
Well, either wasted time, wasted procedures. The most commonly done operation in orthopedics today is putting an arthroscope into the knee and trimming up the cartilage for someone who has pain. Well-done studies, interestingly enough, out of Canada, very well controlled, have shown that a year later, there is no difference between people who have the arthroscopy plus physical therapy against physical therapy alone. But in a fee-for-service world, you operate because that's how you generate the income. Context, fee-for-service, shapes perception about what's indicated, not the medical literature, and that's how you behave.
You make it sound as if the accounting department was driving medical care.
It's not an accounting department, and it's not even conscious. That's the point of the book. This is a subconscious way to go. I'll give you a great example. The test for prostate disease. There's a group of organizations called Choosing Wisely that asked each of the specialties to come up with those things that seem unnecessary. The what's called the PSA, this test is a very sensitive test,
right,
that often finds disease that either doesn't exist or is not going to be life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
The primary care physicians, the family medicine physicians, the internal medicine physicians said this test is not adding any value. Of 1,000 people, it changes the outcome in maybe one, and there's a lot of negative consequences for the ones who have false positives. Mm-hmm. Guess what the Urology Society decided?
Go ahead.
Definitely indicated, because that's the driver of this operation.
That leads you to the procedure.
Another great example to me is hysterectomy. What we know now is that it is best done through a laparoscope, actually two, but through a scope, because then rather than spending 6 weeks recovering.
Less invasive.
Much less invasive, much faster recovery.
Yeah.
What's the problem? The problem is it's tougher to do through a small scope. So you better have a lot of experience. I asked the chiefs of OBGYN, most of whom are women, if you're going to have this procedure done, how many do you want your surgeon to have done in the previous year? And they all said somewhere between 2 to 3 a month, 25 to 35 cases a year.
Mm-hmm.
Half of the surgeons, of the OBGYN surgeons in the United States today, do fewer than 10. But they can't see it. It doesn't change that behavior. So the opportunity to understand how changing the context of medicine, that's why I wrote the book. I talk about four pillars. Ways that we can reshape American healthcare to improve it. In the same way those experiments got people to do destructive things, we can do positive things.
You're talking about changing an entire culture.
Changing an entire culture, system, reimbursement, technology, leadership. This is massive. But the American healthcare system is getting in bigger and bigger trouble. We're watching prices rise. The Commonwealth Fund looked at the 11 industrialized nations of the world. The only area we led the world, cost 50% more than any other country in this world. Outcome-wise, dead last. Shortest life expectancy. Second highest chance of a child dying prematurely. A girl born in Seoul, Korea today has a life expectancy 7 years longer than a girl born in the United States.
Well, doctor, if you get in some sort of catastrophic medical trouble, are you better off getting a plane ticket to somewhere?
There's a lot of great care being provided. You and I talked a little bit in the past about opportunities to go to places that have the highest volume, some of which are outside the United States today, mm-hmm. where you see people who are doing these operations time and time and time again with the results that are remarkable. I think the most important thing you should be asking someone, unless you're in a car wreck, because now you go to the local facility.
Right.
But if you're going to have a procedure done, what you want to ask people is, how many of these have you done in the past? You want to look for someone who specializes in that particular area and when there's objective data. You know, it's interesting. President Clinton, after he finished his two terms, his wife, as you know, ran for president of the United States. Before that, she was the senator from New York. They moved to Westchester County, just outside the city. New York City publishes risk-adjusted, very well-controlled data, third decimal point on heart outcomes for all 35 hospitals in the greater New York area. When he developed chest pain, where did he go? The hospital with the second worst outcomes. Then he needs surgery. Where does he go? To the hospital with the worst outcomes. By the surgeon who has the highest complication rate. And guess what happens to Clinton? He gets a complication. It's not rare. It's just that context shapes perception, the reputation, the brand, the amount of marble in the lobby. No. Look at the data. Ask the right questions. Make sure, if you have a choice, because it's not a super, super emergency, that you're able to find the place with the best experience and the greatest specialization.
We'll keep that in mind, doctor. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Mistreated, why we think we're getting great health care, and why we're usually wrong, all profits to Doctors Without Borders. Thank you very much.
Dr. Robert Pearl is the former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, the nation's largest medical group, and he's speaking on Thursday at the Estes Park Institute Conference at the Grand Wailea on Maui. That conference continues through Friday. You can learn more about the doctor and the conference on our Facebook page.
Aloha, I'm Concepcion Alucino, producer of Juventud Film. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Civil Beat. Chad Blair joins us this morning to talk about the news and the latest Trump pick for the Intermediate Court of Appeals. Morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
So far, so good for the nominee, Mark Bennett?
Yeah, you know, I can't remember the last time that Brian Schatz and Mazie Hirono have said something nice about something that President Trump has done. Of course, they belong to different parties, Republicans versus Democrats, but both senators are praising President Trump's nomination of Mark Bennett, who, as we all know, is the former attorney general for Hawaii under Governor Lingle, which, of course, she was a Republican, too. But he's being characterized, Bennett, as highly competent, a principled attorney with good judicial temperament. Remember that Hirono, even though she is in the minority, she also sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which, of course, will be handling the confirmation hearing on Bennett. So good news so far, assuming that there's nothing that blocks the nomination, a win-win.
Well, now I heard Mark Bennett's name put out there for U.S. attorney,
yeah.
And that slot went to Mr. Price instead. But I also heard names like a former city council member, Charles DeJoux, as a possibility for this slot as well.
Yeah, you know, there's only so many well-known Republicans and lawyers in the state of Hawaii. It's a blue state, and that was one of the things that people sort of were wondering is whether the president would look favorably. Because remember, he has been very critical of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the very bench that Bennett has been nominated for. Of course, it's the largest of the districts, the appellate courts. It includes not only Hawaii, but the western states, and it has a far-reaching mandate. It also includes the U.S. territory, so all the way to Guam. And so there was some concern because this is the same court that intervened with the preliminary travel ban, remember, from the primarily Muslim countries. And the court has been criticized as being fairly liberal. Others have said that, no, in fact, it's a little bit more balanced than you really think it is. But another thing that you wondered, the president who is criticizing this court actually picking a judge from the bluest state in the nation.
Right. But he's also the second Hawaii judge that we've had on that bench.
Right. Rick Clifton, I believe, I don't know if he stepped down just yet, but he also was appointed by a Republican president, George Bush. And so you're going to have any number of ideologies. Boy, I can't say that word this morning. Different political and perspectives. Let's put it that way. The courts are different, but definitely the Ninth is very influential.
Right. And Bennett has a, you know, pretty wide background. Varied background in different fields. So
yes, he does. He's also, yeah, I think so too. He's also argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. So we'll see how things go in the U.S. Senate.
All right. Thanks a lot, Chad. That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat.
During yesterday's panel discussion of ocean safety, we had a number of calls and emails that did not make it on the air. Here are a few of them.
Aloha, my name is Kristen. I'm calling from Maui. I feel like there should be some sort of an extra brochure handed out to tourists as they get off the plane, even giving them the most basic information on how to identify a rip current or duck under a wave properly, or maybe even a link to some sort of a website where they can get that kind of information. I just feel like there's such basic lack of knowledge when it comes to ocean safety, even just in the shore break, right at the shoreline, not even getting out into the snorkeling and all of that. I think we need to start right there when they get to the edge of the water, educating them on things they should know at that point. Thank you very much.
This is Carrie. I'm commenting about the snorkeling instruction. I have been an instructor for decades in the Midwest, came here. There is a general pushback on snorkeling. I was doing it through the individual park districts, and I think that that is something that's needed. We were doing 10,000 a year in the Chicago area. We don't have that quantity here that are getting trained, but it also should be available to people at shoreline. Also, again, having snorkeling vests, proper equipment, learning how to use the equipment, because it is the most dangerous part of the whole thing, is knowing how to properly get gear up and live with that gear in the water. That's all. Bye.
And Phil Treister wrote this via email. I'm sorry, I had to laugh today about your show. Really? People who can't swim, go snorkeling? I just don't get it. What about personal responsibility? We shouldn't even need lifeguards. Tell me how humans survived the ocean 1,000 years ago.
Danette sent us this from Kula, Maui. Please also consider that drownings are not the only issue. There are a large number of tourists to Maui who are critically injured every year with broken necks and other severe injuries, some paralyzed for life. I appreciated seeing the placement of videos in baggage claim, the ones with Branscombe Richmond, but they're played on screens that are dwarfed by screens 4 times their size, which tout luau's, restaurants, shopping malls, etc. No one seems to be watching Branscombe. An idea to consider might be having public service ads on the back of menus. Can we get some hotels and restaurants to buy into something like that?
Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. And if you have something to say, you can call our talkback line at 808-792-817 or call us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation. Iao Stream or Wailuku River? That was just one of the sensitive issues. It was recently before the Board of Geographic Names. It was a contentious battle because of the water rights fight on the Valley Isle. When water was diverted for sugar, the flow into the river trickled and became a stream, thus the name Eau Stream. Now that the last sugar mill has shut down, the talk about restoring the water and reclaiming the name Wailuka River has underscored the importance of place names. Marcus Marzon is the chairman of the Board of Geographic Names. He talks about the complexities of what's in a name.
The Hawaii Board of Geographic Names was established in 1974, and the intention of its establishment was to create a uniformity of spelling as well as use of and the naming of them in geographic features within the state. So over the years, the use of Okina and Kahakou have not been used, and sometimes they have been in certain districts in certain areas. So it's the board's job to unify and standardize all of those practices.
And it's probably easier said than done.
It is, very much so. Particularly when there are issues related to places that have multiple parts to it. For instance, Kalihi, the valley of Kalihi has Kalihiuka, Kalihiwaina, and Kalihikai. So depending on the different areas of the valley, there's the upland part of Kalihi, there's the middle part, and then there's the ocean side of Kalihi. So there are places like that across the state that have those little descriptors that add to the nuance of the place. And, you know, to try and standardize that across the state so that all names are equally addressed is an issue.
Now, I've also heard a controversy over Mauna Kea, Mauna Loa, that it used to be two words, and then it was down to one word, and now it's back to two words and may go back down again. Explain all that.
So that's along the lines of this idea of descriptors or words used to describe places. In the current guidelines that we have as the Hawaii Board on Geographic Names, if there are terms that are just descriptions, then the idea of separating is a practice that we do. If there is a combining, concatenating the words is what we try to do, bring them together into one word. But if there's a name for say in the example of Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa, the idea that Kea might have been the name of the mountain. Yeah, instead of a descriptor of the color white, yeah, a white mountain versus the mountain of Kea. Yeah, so in an instance like that where the second part of the word is a proper name associated to a particular person or a figure, then it would be separate because it's two separate entities versus just a descriptor.
Right, so I imagine there's a lot of debate in the community about
correctly.
This because not everybody.
So
will
there's
agree.
Not a lot of there's not a lot of resources or information, and a lot of people have different viewpoints on that issue. The idea is it Kea just a descriptor of the mountain, the snow that falls on the mountain when it's the wintertime, or is it a term that actually is the name of the mountain? So it's not the mountain. A mountain of white, but actually Kea, the mountain is the name of the mountain is Kea, but it is a mountain. So,
and then what about how you folks attack this strategically? Do you go? Have you been going island by island?
Yes, currently we are on names reviewing names on the island of Molokai at the moment. When we finish that, we will work our way on towards Oahu. So we started on Hawaii Island. Working our way up the island chain, ending with Kauai and Niihau. And again, there have been a lot of names that we have not addressed because of the resources of research that needs to be done and other kinds of information gathering processes that we have to do to confirm certain names. So we've left a lot of those names to the side for more research so that when we come back later, we can have a little more time to really deal with those things properly.
Right. And I know there are many names that people have stopped using, and they refer to places like the Seven Sacred Pools on Maui or Chinaman's Hat here on Oahu.
Yes.
So how do you deal with that?
So in instances like that, we actually wait for community groups to come and present those proposals to us as a name restoration or a name change. because of it's mostly the community that's important in those situations. The example that you brought up of the seven sacred pools, the community actually presented a proposal to the board, and we actually went out to Maui and had community meetings there to talk about different issues and related matters with the community there. And we heard all of their testimonies and feedback, and with all of that knowledge and education from the community, we made the decision to call it, return the original name, Ohe'o, back to the place. Yeah.
Right, so even though all the tourists refer to it as Seven Sacred Pools or it's on the tourist maps.
Yes, so Ohe'o is the official name for that place, and that's how it's recorded in both the state and federal board.
Right, and here we have Diamond Head or Leahi.
Correct.
And Chinaman's Hat. I don't know what the real name
Mokoli'i.
Is. Mokoli'i.
Mokoli'i. Is its
right, and then you've got the sandbar name as well.
Yes, Kahualaka. Yes.
So lots of education needs to be done, re-education maybe.
Correct.
Of the proper names and the original names.
Yes. So it does come down to the communities, particularly when names like that come about. It's not our we don't have the right to just change names. We have to actually get community involvement and have meetings about that so that our decisions are actually from an informed place, not just our own personal feelings of the subject and what we personally as a board feel is appropriate.
And I understand right now you're also looking at names within national parks.
Correct. At the moment, we have a series of names that we've been dealing with, particularly with the national parks, the Volcano National Park, because of a mapping project that they're working on at the moment. And because the national park has a separate jurisdiction to, you know, within the state, we don't have the authority to change the name outright because it is a federal facility and federal-run area. So we have the opportunity to provide our recommendation to the park and see what they feel is appropriate, and they would take it on from the steps on from that point.
So I can see when you're making a change, it can be a very long process.
Very much so. Yes, there are a lot of levels that can really alter the direction of how a name gets implemented and the time frame.
Or the change, like in the case of Mauna Kea, Mauna Loa, where it's gone back and forth.
Correctly, because there's so many different viewpoints on what the name actually represents and all of the back, the very strong cases that the two sides are presenting. It's really hard to really determine which one is the appropriate the name to choose at the current time. I think one of the thoughts that was brought up amongst some of the conversations is to maybe think about the idea of creating a dual system to have multiple names as official names for particular sites to give the weight and authority and integrity of multiple perspectives in the naming of places. So that's something still under discussion. We haven't formalized anything like that yet, but there have been discussions like that really allow for a greater understanding of names and the development of names and how they're used.
That was Marcus Marzan, the chairman of the Hawaii State Board on Geographic Places. He represents the Bishop Museum on the 7-member board, which meets monthly. It actually meets tomorrow to continue tackling the weighty issues of what's in a name. I'm Catherine Cruz, and this is The Conversation.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting guitarist Makana performing a Valentine's concert 7:30 p.m. this Friday at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we took a look back at Hawaii's tumultuous labor history. The dock strikes of 1941 and 1971 strained Hawaii's economy and highlighted our dependence on the shipping industry, but neither proved to be the longest strike Hawaii has ever seen. That title goes to a group of longshoremen who walked off the docks at Ahukini Landing in Kauai. The 1940 Ahukini strike not only strengthened the ILWU presence in Hawaii, it also brought together groups of people who had never fought side by side before. Historically, Hawaii labor groups were divided along racial lines, resulting in ethnically segregated union divisions. In the case of Ahukini, most of the workers were Filipino. When shipment was halted at Ahukini, ships moved to an alternate dock, Port Allen, where the workers were almost entirely Japanese. The Port Allen longshoremen refused to scab out their neighbors and joined the protest, refusing shipment as well. Together, for over 9 months, Japanese and Filipino workers closed the ports of Kauai and continued to protest pay and working conditions. While the 298-day strike didn't result in any major gains for the workers, it did help break down the barriers of race in the union movement here in Hawaii. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, offering flexibility for on-the-go students and families with 24/7 access to Achieve 3000 Hawaii Edition, online or offline. Achieve3000.com.
For almost 50 years, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York has let you pay what you want. Not, however, anymore.
Everybody should have access to art. You know, everybody should be able to enjoy it and see it. And I don't think it's fair to deprive people.
I'm Kai Rizdal, one of the world's great museums, for $25 a head. That's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
Storytelling is one of the primal art forms with roots as old as human language. Its practice is at the heart of Hawaiian culture, whose history was preserved in mele, handed down through the generations. Moses Goods is a theater artist who's mastered a variety of disciplines, but all of them have storytelling at their heart. He's crafted the work of a lifetime into a storytelling event called Kinolau to be performed this weekend at Honolulu Theater for Youth. He spoke with us about the role of storytelling in Hawaiian culture.
The role in storytelling in the past was to preserve knowledge. We didn't have a written language, so the storyteller was extremely important. I like to say, talk about the importance of different people in a community. You have a kahuna kalaiva'a. So he is the carver of a canoe, right? The canoe carver. Very serious thing, because if he doesn't do his job well, people can die. Mm-hmm. Well, for a person that would tell stories, their job is important as well. And if they don't do their job well, then stories are lost. People's memories are lost. Mm-hmm. And to continue to say the names of our ancestors is to continue to acknowledge that they live. So if these stories die, then in essence our kupuna, our ancestors, die because they're no longer remembered. So really important thing.
And in Hawaiian culture, it is a person rather than a document that is the home of the story.
Yeah, we did not write down we had no written language, so everything was memorized. We had people whose job it was to memorize mele, to memorize chant, and so I would imagine that's what their entire existence was. From morning to evening, they would just work on memorizing these chants because it's that important. That was their role in the society.
How do you evoke that in a contemporary manner to a contemporary audience?
It's difficult because, as you know, a lot of the culture has been lost. So really, we know that we had storytellers. We really don't know exactly how those stories were told, other than hula and chant. But a person that would just, you know, sit around and tell stories, we know those types of people existed, but we don't know the form. So it's what I do is I rely on what I have today. I'm a trained actor. I'm a writer. I'm a theater artist. I'm also in a halau, so that's, you know, I have a background in hula. So I try to incorporate all the things that I bring as an artist to my style of storytelling. But mm-hmm. I can't say that my style of storytelling is a traditional style because it's, like I said, we don't really have knowledge of how that form was.
But it's kind of coming out of that tradition.
I like to believe that it is. Yeah, I mean, that's when I write, a lot of times things will just happen and they're on the page and I'm like, well, where did that come from? It's got to be an ancestor. It's got to be a kupuna that wants these stories to be told. I truly believe that when I tell these stories, it's bigger than me. The stories want to be told.
How do you decide which ones are the ones you want to emphasize?
It depends. A lot of times I like to dig for stories that aren't known as well. I mean, I always tell the stories about, you know, Maui, Kamapua'a, and Pele. Those are kind of the standards. But mm-hmm. I try to dig a little bit deeper sometimes and look for stories that people don't always hear.
What would be an example of one of those?
An example, well, not one that I'm telling in this particular production, but the story of Kane Apua. That's, over the years, has become one of my main go-to stories, and I tell that a lot. But growing up, I actually never heard that story before. And when I found it, I'm like, oh my goodness, it's this epic tale about this young Akua that has to journey back to the homeland, Kahiki, and he encounters all these amazing and fantastical obstacles, really. So it's kind of like this big odyssey that he has to go on, mm-hmm. voyaging back to his homeland.
You know, it's fascinating, Moses, how many stories from around the world involve a hero, mm-hmm. a journey, mm-hmm. a hero who overcomes a series. I'm thinking of Odysseus, for example, mm-hmm. a hero who overcomes a series of obstacles to get to, you know, an important goal. What is it about those stories? Why do you think there's that universality to stories people tell around the world? What are they trying to get across?
I think it's just the human existence, right? I mean, it's just things that register in our minds. I think just as humans, no matter what culture you're from, those are the stories that we tend to want to hear. And in what I'm doing in this piece, it is taking that whole idea and really trying to make it accessible for an audience today. So a lot of these stories, they're traditional stories, but I'm tweaking them in such a way where it could be a kid that comes to one of our morning shows, you know, in the middle of this story. I'm trying to make it accessible to the kids now.
Should a good story inspire?
Absolutely, yeah. A good story should inspire. A good story should have the audience imagining that they're the ones in that story, living that adventure or going through that obstacle. Definitely.
And as a theater artist, you've studied the various ways there are to get people involved, right? The various, not just techniques of theater, but the whole idea behind theater is to create that kind of interaction, that involvement.
Yeah, I've studied technique, but really, I mean, the best way to do it is just to be in front of people as much as you can, telling these stories, because then you get to, you know, you pick up on what makes them react, you know, what makes them laugh, and it's, you know, it's not necessarily always a formula and a technique. Mm-hmm. It's being in that moment and connecting with them.
And that's based on your having told these stories to live audiences and kind of getting that feeling back.
Yeah, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely.
Is that, I would think that particular interaction, the interaction with the live audience, would be kind of essential to a storyteller.
Yeah, yeah.
And that each audience would be a little different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How do you know what it is that an audience wants?
You got to feel it out, you know. One thing I try to do early on in any story is you gotta open that doorway up for them to walk through with you, and if they do, then we're on the adventure together, right? Mm-hmm. If they don't, then it's just me on stage saying a bunch of words, right? So some of that is in the way I design the script that I use. I usually do stories that are scripted, but some of it is just letting the story breathe as I tell it, you know, just not just waiting for that moment, or being sensitive to that moment when it happens, and you kind of feel it. And I can't even describe what it is, but you know, it's like, okay, they're with you. And it's a humbling thing, because they're choosing to be there with you. And so it's like, I have on stage, I have kind of a kuleana, a responsibility. They're opening themselves up to what I'm doing and where I'm taking them. And so I'm responsible to take them to these places and not abuse that, if that makes any sense.
Moses Goods is the director and creator of Kino Lau, a limited engagement Hawaiian storytelling event that runs this weekend at the Tenney Theater in downtown Honolulu. It's a Honolulu Theater for Youth production, and you can learn more about it on our Facebook page.
Hi, I'm Bianca from Becker Communications. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
The government in Britain has been pouring money into offshore wind power. Private investors, too, making one of the cleanest ways of producing electricity also affordable.
This is a low-carbon technology, but more importantly, it's a really cheap way now of generating energy.
Britain's successful push for offshore wind power, that's on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
That's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, what are policymakers doing to control construction of monster houses?
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us a comment. Do you have a monster in your neighborhood? The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on The Conversation page, with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.